Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth, straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden. I'm working
an Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
All right, Chuck and Julie on Party Friday. Welcome to Chuck and Julie Show. Chuck Bino, Julie Hayden, two straight up. Beautiful day out there. Nothing but sunshine.
Yeah, gorgeous.
And we have a sunshine show.
That's right. As always.
As always.
Chuck
always.
Is actually known, you
as
know,
Mr. Sunshine.
As Mr. Sunshine.
You can call me Mr. Sunshine.
Call him Mr.
Like
Sunshine,
it.
Exactly. Hey, show brought to you in part sponsored by ColoradoCitizenPress.com, Colorado's conservative voice. Great website, one to check out every day.
Yeah, they got a great article on Are the Powers of Polis Unlimited as he goes. Now September, the emergency. I mean, even in Rome, they limited the appointment of dictators in times of emergency.
Oh, no, not here in Colorado.
But it's a great article, so go Colorado Citizen Press anytime you can possibly do it.
That's right. Got a great show. We got Patrick Neville on the line. We'll get to him in 1 second. Also, coming up at 3:15, packed show today, Tim McCormick, Adams County District Attorney candidate, to talk about the skyrocketing crime rate all over the place. We had a friend whose car was broken into, and the cops told him that's up 40% in Denver. I wonder why. Then, sort of a switching gears here, at 3:30, we read a great book. A friend of ours gave us a book by an attorney who is a recovering attorney, which Chuck knows something about. We'll talk to him. And then Jan Cook at 3:50, toward the end of the show, talking about a brand new book that's coming out that we're all going to want to participate and take a look at. But first, let's jump into Patrick. Hey, Patrick, thank you as always, and welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah. Did you see the article in Politico? It talked about how Trump in 23 states, and I don't think Colorado was included in it, but you never know, had knocked on over 1 million doors. They're going door to door talking to voters, where the Democrats were, as usual, staying at home doing the Joe Biden technique. Did you read that article?
No, I didn't.
Well, it's just fascinating. And
those 23 other states.
Yeah. Well, that's absolutely
maybe,
right.
And,
well, I mean, you know, as I've kind of a sick on the subject, but, I'm a PCP here. So I can identify 30 people that are younger males that are independent, and they may not be Democrats, they may not be Republicans. But since there's no organized effort to find out what they are and try to get them to vote, only the Democrats have done it in the past. This year, they seem to be a little slow. But as far as I can tell, the Democratic the Trump campaign in Colorado is moribund.
And I'm going to disagree with that. And well, let Patrick
you can talk to them all.
What's your sense?
Well, I think it's been better than past years, but it still has a lot of work to go. I mean, it's not, we're not seeing, we're hearing that there's so many contacts made. And, I haven't really seen the evidence of that. I haven't seen, I mean, it's kind of working. It depends kind of county by county, too, it seems like. It seems like there's certain counties that are being pretty effective. Actually, Jeffco's actually done a pretty decent job, at least working with the House candidates and stuff, getting some people out. And then other counties where maybe the RNC or the Trump campaign just doesn't want to work with folks there, so they're not really focusing on those areas, or they're just kind of doing it in a very secluded manner, not including people in. So.
Secluded. I like it. Very secluded manner. Yeah. Very secluded.
Let me ask you, sort of switching gears to something I know we've talked about with you before, but I think bears repeating. So once again, Polis is extended for no apparent reason, the emergency orders. We're still in the same place, right? He can do that if he wants to, and there really isn't anything anyone can do to stop him, right?
No, the only thing, I mean, we could do is pass something to actually stop it. But when we're sitting in a minority in the House and the Senate, it's really difficult to do.
How do you pass anything when the emergency's on and he can just simply declare?
Yeah. What if he declares as an emergency, Patrick?
Well, we could technically call a special session with a 2/3 vote, but how are we going to get 2/3?
Right.
And you could also go to Mars and bring back some Martians.
And the other thing, too, is that I get really scared about is everyone says, well, you guys should go into special session to figure this out.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Well, when we are in the minority, Do we really want to go into a special session? No. What they did the last session.
Right.
They totally ran over us. So unless we can get it totally defined to a very specific item, I'd hesitate going into a special session.
Oh, they'll still rat you, no matter what you
what
do.
What about this? So it seems to me, as we're getting closer to the election, that polls are having an impact. This poll I disagreed with. I mean, 80% of the people said they think people should wear masks, so all of a sudden Donald Trump now wants us to wear a mask. I disagree with that. On the other hand, though, 80% of the people say schools should open, and voila, New York's Governor Cuomo announced, hey, guess what? Schools in New York are going to open. We saw this happen at the beginning of this whole nonsense when the really, really liberal states kind of had the most, I guess, stringent actions, and then Colorado followed suit. Do you think that maybe now some of the polls are showing people are sick of lockdowns, people want the schools to open? Do you see that having an impact here in Colorado? Hopefully, I think.
No, because the teachers union controls everything, and they control all the school boards, and it's just amazing. You know, we actually brought this up to the governor, you know, recently, and his thing was, well, we got local control in the school boards. Well, let them deal with it. I'm like, well, you certainly won't let us deal with that on whether or not we want to reopen our county here in Douglas County, or whether or not, you know, a specific coffee shop wants to open. You're certainly willing to exercise extreme state authority over all those decisions and have people beg the crown for their variance. But, oh, but with schools, it's on them. That's their decision. And what he's basically doing is passing the buck.
Right,
he doesn't want to take any heat for that. But we should absolutely be looking at, I'm kind of worried what CDE is going to do with count day. I mean, as long as I think it should be business as usual when it comes to count day. And if schools aren't opening, or they're pushing folks into some sort of virtual program, then we shouldn't be giving them the same type of funding, because it's not the same type of program.
I agree. It's like, why should the schools get paid when parents? And, you know, here's the thing, too. I find this odd. I think some of the liberal media things are trying to shame parents who are looking at all, like, getting tutors and things like that. They were calling them pods, and, you know, wealthy, affluent white people were going to do this. But I think, whatever your circumstance, if the school isn't educating your kid, you should.
No, you're not allowed to. No, media will tell you can't educate. They must be as dumb as the dumbest student in the state.
Right. It's just amazing. All these things that they had coming forward in the past of, oh, we have to have this. We have to have this. We need school counselors in here, and we need more funding for the schools. And schools are so essential. It's so essential we need to have, you know, mandatory sex education in all the different schools. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden, oh, well, no, schools aren't that essential. We should all stay home and, you know, just do it online.
Right.
I was curious about your statement.
It's really bad news.
I was curious about your statement that Jeffco seems to be doing better. Is that because Colin Larson has all Hillary Clinton's money, and so he can do a lot of work to destroy the Republican Party in his own right?
Oh, I don't know. Or maybe it's just the fact that, you know, the folks of the Trump campaign like people in Jeffco, and that's kind of
who do they like?
Yeah,
who do they like?
Personalities getting in the way. Well, you typically not guys like me.
Okay. I know, and Dave Williams too,
you know,
right?
And I think it's almost unfortunate. They're trying to it seems like they're trying to line up their next job rather than actually work hard and get the president elected.
That would never happen, Patrick. No. That would never happen. Well, they'll all be sorry, I guess, in the end. If
How's your lawsuit going?
It's good, yeah. So Randy's still working on that. There's some other stuff that actually got added to it recently, so it's taken a little longer, but he's making sure that we do it right. We're probably going to be filing it sometime shortly, but it's going to be – it might actually have a larger effect than what we originally planned to do. Originally, it was a plan to just kind of stick to the mask mandate, but there's some other stuff that falls in line there, and some other constitutional language that probably needs to be questioned, and so it might have a larger effect than just the mask.
I would think
out there that's already set. So, I told him I'd rather than just be the first one out to file to try to get the publicity, I'd rather do this one right.
So
give him the time he needs. He's got a good team down there.
What are you trying to explain to folks? What are you trying to do with it?
Well, you know, I just think that the mask mandate's unconstitutional on its face, and then there's actually some other precedent out there. You know, in the recent cases, I don't want to get too big into it because I don't want to give up all the dirty details of it to the opponents that might be listening before it gets filed. But it's one of those ones that it's as they start digging through and they need more data on this and that. And it's just I've been telling them to do your work. You know, I don't want to do this right. This is not just a the publicity
stunt. Publicity stunt.
Yeah, well, also the whole,
do it accurately and correctly.
The whole emergency provisions have to be unconstitutional to the extent there's really no limit to it. I mean, yes, you can call a joint session, but that if that means that one party, as long as it controls one house, has in fact can install a dictatorship for all time. And really, when you look at the crisis, this is quote-unquote a crisis, the number of people dying in Colorado from the coronavirus is one, two, if you believe that's even one or two. Yeah. Well, why couldn't the governor declare it a crisis about all the deaths on the road due to auto accidents?
Or vending machines or something.
Or vending machines.
People die from vending machines.
Or stubbing their toes. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, there seems to be an unlimited power to do unlimited things for an unlimited period of time. We might as well not have a democracy. Well, we don't really have one with mail-in voting, but might as well not have a democracy.
Well, and, you know, I think the unlimited power he's taking is might have been, in his views, given to him statutorily, but I don't think it's constitutionally there.
Yeah,
right. Exactly.
That's kind of the question we need to get. And they basically said that to him in the Ritchie v. Polis case on the electronic signature gathering.
Right.
They
said essentially that. And so that's kind of a recent precedent that we got to look at. And if you look at some other language just on actually balance of power, I think it's even more limiting than what they went off of in that case. And so, again, pretty complex stuff. I'm not the attorney, but I want to give them the time to do it. And we are raising money for that lawsuit. So that's a www.stopthemaskmandate.com. People can donate there.
Okay. Great. Final question for you, Patrick. Anything else? I like to always ask this. Anything else you think folks need to be keeping an eye on that you're keeping an eye on?
Not anything particular right now. I mean, I think just there's going to be the one thing I guess I could throw out is on the 11th, this Tuesday, there's supposed to be this governor briefing us about the coronavirus.
Oh, yeah.
And the and also the capital damage. We'll see. I think it's turning more and more into a dog and pony show instead of actually us being able to ask real questions. Of course, they said we want all the questions submitted beforehand. Well,
it's all part of the Democratic Party. And come up with the answer. You ought to submit to that. I mean, absolutely. Maybe like a Joe Biden interview.
I mean, you guys are equal branches of the government.
The government,
right?
You can't ask us any questions we don't approve of.
That really annoys me. Yeah. You know what? Submit a stupid question and then ask a real one.
Yeah.
Make them so.
Well, what's funny too is, if people don't understand, I mean, since he started Progress Now and he's dumped so many millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars throughout, you know, the past couple of decades into Colorado politics, a lot of people owe them, you know, Democrats owe their careers to the governor too. So
yes,
it's really tough to get any Democrats to actually stand up to the governor.
Oh, God, no.
Because they owe him some favors.
That's right.
Well, they don't. I mean, have you ever seen it? I mean, and there are all kinds of maverick Republicans, you know. Have you ever heard of a maverick Democrat? They don't exist.
That's because they take him to
the woodshed. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's apparently a Mitt Romney's in the Senate willing or on the Supreme Court, but does it ever go the other way? It doesn't seem to. It doesn't seem to.
Oh, well, Patrick, listen.
Well, let him respond to
that,
Julie.
Yeah, he says okay.
Okay, well, that's a response.
All right, Patrick, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Patrick.
Have a great weekend.
All right, thanks, guys.
All right.
Take
Thank
care.
You, Patrick Neville there. We'll keep an eye on that.
He's
August
great.
11th.
God,
he is
he's
great.
Just wonderful.
Submit their questions. Submit,
and they probably will. Yeah. Oh, yeah, let's do that. Let's go to Tim McCormick now. He's a DA candidate up in
Adams County.
And
where we live.
Well, we live, you know, under the wonderful rule of Democrats also. We've had him on once before, got such a positive response. We wanted to have him back on. So welcome back, Tim.
Well, that's great. Hey, thanks, Chuck, Julie. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, we sure can. Sure
right.
can.
Coming across loud and clear. Yes, thank you very much for having me on and for the opportunity to converse.
Well, why don't I talk to you about the crime rates soaring in Democrat-controlled cities? We have a friend who had his car broken into right over the weekend. Well, I guess earlier this week in Denver. And he said the police officer who responded said those kind of calls, burglaries, were up 40%. In Denver since the beginning of the year. I was watching Channel 4 had a decent story on where they showed that officer-initiated contacts were down across like the country, like 70%, almost non-existent anymore. Meanwhile, shockingly, people are rioting, destroying the Capitol. I got punched at that rally. Cops did nothing. Homicide rate is up. you know,
all is going well.
All is going well. And they know we can't have trials, really, because and we have to let the bad guys out of jail. What's your take? I mean, you maybe give people a brief explanation of your background in law enforcement and then your take on the whole thing.
Sure. I appreciate that. And you know, you asked me about my take and I kind of chuckled because the last time we talked, you know, the world was looking totally different. And then here we are a few weeks later and it's really getting tough to keep up with this. It surely is. As I said, I'm Tim McCormick. I'm running for district attorney for Adams and Broomfield County. It's about 1,200 square miles of jurisdiction. I've done this for 28 years and I want to use my 28 years of experience to return integrity, unbiased decision-making, and just leadership back to that office. I think, unfortunately, over the last couple of years, there's been a lot of issues with the office and how it's being run and some of the things that are going on there, you know, and I think there's a dire need for change in the office that serves it. And, you know, I think I pledge to lead that way to get through this scandal plagued mismanagement of that office, because honestly, at the end of the day, if we don't change that culture of leadership, it's just going to continue uninterrupted. 28 years a prosecutor, started my career up in Wyoming, worked here in Adams County. I'm currently employed at the Jefferson County DA's office. I've done all kinds of cases. I firmly believe in, you know, good people make mistakes. You know, if they come into the system, you get them in, you get them out, you know, but focus on those that are praying on a regular basis in our community, and you have to face facts. And I don't think people like this sometimes, but we found this out in our campaign. Yeah, evil exists. You know, you can't ignore it, okay? You've got to address it, you've got to confront it, and you've got to basically forfeit their right to live amongst us. So you brought up a lot of questions, a lot of things going on. You know, let's talk about crime rate lately. I read an article here within the last week. For the first 6 or 7 months here in the Colorado area, specifically in Denver, they've seen an increase of almost 46.2% in murder, 22.7% in aggravated assault, 35% in burglaries, 11% in theft from motor vehicles, and a whopping 65% increase in arson. I've also looked at some recent polls as well. You know, you have 80%, over 80% of African Americans who don't want defunding the police. Right. And they actually say there needs to be more police in their areas. I read a poll that 85% of Americans believe that crime is a serious issue. Well, absolutely it is.
Right.
And over 76% of registered voters do not support this whole defund the police movement. I also think, you know, when you take kind of a big look and work our way down to our jurisdiction, you've seen significant increases in crime all over the place. New York, Chicago, Minneapolis, Kansas City, all these places, right? I was floored earlier this week when the chief of police from Seattle basically came out and told her residents, right, and business owners, you're on your own.
Right.
And nothing we can do. Followed up by the Minneapolis chief of police saying, you're on your own. Actually, he even went a step further and says, I want you to be good victims. You know, give up your car, give up your loved ones, give up your kids, give up your keys, your wallet, your cell phone. And I don't know, call me crazy, Chuck and Julie, but, I don't think that's going to deter criminal activity in the future. I think that's going to empower your criminals.
Well, you know, here's my experience. I covered crime and courts and stuff a lot.
Well, Julie's interviewed, you talk about does evil exist. Julie's interviewed as many or more mass murderers than almost anybody. So she's got to see the face of evil up close and personal.
And I think there is that. But I also think that, as you said, sometimes good people do bad things. But one of the things that keeps all of us on the straight and narrow is we don't have to be evil. We can just be tempted, shall we say, but it is the possibility of consequences. Mm-hmm. And you weigh yourself like, okay, well, I kind of feel like breaking into my neighbor. I'm not an evil person, but I want their whatever.
Nice right. pull cue.
They're not. Yeah. And so I'm going to break in and get it. But the thought that what might happen to me when I, you know, the cost and the benefits keeps people from doing the bad thing. For instance, I'll confess, I like to get to where I'm going in a hurry, right? But the thought of getting a ticket and having my insurance goes up keeps me from speeding.
But this is an interesting point of how people are feeling, because we went down to the Support the Blue rally, and you know, Julie got punched in the face and she told the particular Antifa person, you know, is that all you got? Driving back home, I-25, and there's a particular, you know, kind of speed trap one where it goes from 65 to 55, then quickly back to 65. But so you said, oh, I better slow down here. And then what was your reaction, Julie?
Well, then I thought, screw that, frankly. I thought they couldn't protect me. The cops stood by and didn't do anything while I got punched. And now they're going to take their time to give me a ticket. But back to the consequences thing, I just personally think a lot of this has been showing people who might be inclined to commit crimes that they can do that and nothing's going to happen to them.
Well, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You're onto something there. When I talk about empowering, and I know your situation down there, I followed that. I'm terribly sorry that happened. Oh. You know, let me ask you a kind of a rhetorical question, I think is what it is. Have you been contacted by a victim advocate from the Denver District Attorney's Office?
Denver's District Attorney, Beth McCann?
The freaking person is on tape. I got her. Michelle Malkin got her.
If she's lucky, Beth McCann will charge her with running her face into the poor protester's fist. That's what Beth McCann will do.
And that's a great, and that's what I'm, and I was being a bit rhetorical and facetious on that because, you know, that's what the concern is when you talk about lack of consequences. You know, I can't think of any mass protester arrest, mass protester charges announcement. No. And somehow they're trying to, and it's not working real well, but they're trying to convince you that these protests are peaceful. Well, they're anything but that. I get that. But the concern you have is, and when you look across the country and right here in our own backyard, these activist DAs that we've seen now Philadelphia, San Francisco, Chicago, Kansas City, St. Louis, you name it. And to the point where they don't even hide it anymore. They come out, yeah, we're not going to charge these people. Well, you're right. What's the where's the incentive to charge if you're the law enforcement officer? Where's the incentive to investigate? And where's the consequences you have? You know, recent story as well. Just I think the other day it's been reported today. You know, we're releasing these inmates because of the virus and things like that. You know what? I understand that because you want to try to alleviate that spread as much as possible. But when you start looking at the news and you see the kind of inmates that are being released, okay, nonviolent, nonviolent property, low criminal history, no criminal history, that type of thing. They got to support staff or support in the community. Great. You just had a story out of Virginia where an individual was charged with rape. They let him out. He goes and he kills the victim. Chuck, I know you're an attorney. If you read that story later on and you read
it. I read it.
Did you see the last paragraph of the two attorneys? Oh, you know, both families, this is tragic for both families.
Yeah.
And we were looking forward to our day in court. Yeah, you know, so much for the victim in that case. But
You won't be able to testify, so maybe they won't bring that at all.
You know, and I think, you know, we're just seeing that increase and you're right. There's no consequences here. And what you're seeing is what concerns me is I've noticed more and more that the criminal law is being weaponized against law abiding citizens. And that's a problem.
Right.
That is a problem. You know, we checked after, you know, having you on and we're so impressed by you with some criminal defense attorneys. We know. And,
they're voting for you.
All right.
You want to let me finish, Julie? Why don't you just go to the punchline?
I'm sorry. Pretend I didn't say that.
but in case people don't know, criminal defense attorneys and prosecutors do not get along. They get along as well as coyotes and lions get along. In fact, there's hatred. I mean, literal hatred for district attorneys because many of them consider district attorneys corrupt, dishonest, who put on no perjured testimony, and I've seen that a lot of district attorneys do put on perjured testimony.
They know it's perjured.
I worked for a criminal defense firm down in Texas, so I have a little of that, but they were unstinting in the praise of you on fairness and everything else, and so that's a real compliment because
I appreciate that, guys. And look, at the end of the day, you got to come out with your integrity and your character intact. I've had the privilege, if you will, of working with a number of defense attorneys across the board. And here's the thing that I would always tell and teach, you know, younger prosecutors and things like that. You can learn a lot from those folks. Okay. There's the antagonistic relationship, but you know what, once you put that part aside and you have a job to do, they have a job to do, You can learn a lot from them. And you know, my position on this is I will always listen. Now, they may not like my answer, right? They may not like my decision, but yeah, I want them to be able to walk away knowing that they at least were listened to and they had a fair shake in the process.
Let me ask you about the question, given my civil libertarian side. What do you think of no-knock raids?
You know, great question. I know authorization is allowed in the statute. You know, the problem is you get it wrong, you got major issues, right, which we've seen across the country. Right. My concern always, too, is that, you know, there has to be some very significant extenuating circumstances and facts present for you to be able to sign off on that, you know, whether it's knowledge of weaponry, violence, that type of stuff, because you do certainly want to take into consideration the safety of the law enforcement, as well as safety of perhaps any individuals in there that aren't associated with the criminal activity. You know, they in certain situations, they serve their purpose, but I really want to take a long, hard look on a case-by-case basis, if that's brought up to the office and it's still allowed, a real, real hard look at them before I sign off.
Yeah, it isn't hard to get a compliant magistrate. It isn't hard, as they did in Houston, they claimed every no-knock raid was a claim there were weapons in the house. And in 90% of the cases, there were no weapons and there were no consequences. And so it is, I remember we were at a discussion and the very law and order guy said, you don't want to run into the police and don't commit crimes. Well, on no-knock raids, you don't have to do anything but sitting there and they butcher you. And it's tiresome. No,
I disagree,
Julie,
with Chuck, just for the record here. Yeah. Chuck, you can't get mad on TV.
She loves the murder, the mayhem. She likes to see the people crawling on the floor with blood because some crooked cop got a crooked
No, we're not.
We're talking real stuff here now, not just a BS, Julie.
Well, and keep in mind, too, that here in Colorado, right, before that gets to the magistrate, there usually has to be an approval as to form signed off by the district attorney. So the officers would do the warrant. They're requesting a no-knock. It has to go up the proper chain, if you will, in the district attorney's office. And then once they're satisfied, they sign off. So to Chuck's point, you're right. If a magistrate looks at it, you know, and I know most of those folks, that the county court judges, et cetera, that review that, they're going to read it. But there's a certain amount of, not acquiescence, but when they see your signature, right, I've approved this as the form, they're thinking, okay, it's gone through that two-step process, but it's kind of
similar to a FISA deal, where the FBI signs off on it, and then everybody else signs off on it, and then the court accepts it, no matter what it is, and everybody's off to a nice SWAT squad to have a fun afternoon.
Let me ask Mark, because we're running out of time.
Sure.
Not Mark, Tim. We've got Mark coming up. Tim, kind of back to what I was originally asking you in terms of my concern is as these crime rates go up, it's not the kind of thing that you can just turn around on a dime. I mean, you just get here all of a sudden and it's not going to go away all of a sudden. Just and so for people like our friend who had their car burglarized, what do you
get good insurance?
Yeah,
increase the insurance amount for full replacement value.
What do you see as maybe some answers?
Well, you know, again, I think part of the problem is that you have to be able to work with your law enforcement. You have to have that kind of relationship. As I told you guys the last time, I've been endorsed by every FOP in the jurisdiction, as well as the state FOP. Since the last time, we've also picked up the endorsement of Mayor Greg Mills in Brighton, Jan Coleman from Thornton, Ben Houston from Commerce City, and we're also fortunate to get former Governor Bill Owens endorsement on board. So again, you know, we have people, our endorsements are...
Last time we saw Bill Owens was at a fundraiser for Michael Hancock.
That's
so his problem. Endorsement these days isn't too good.
Well,
but, no, that's it. Never mind.
We're going to come back on the show. Tim, don't listen to Chuck.
I appreciate it, but one of the things, Chuck, about his endorsement is that you're right. If he's on a different side of the aisle, I have all these people that are on different sides that have these...
Yeah, you do.
But they're all in agreement that something needs to change at the DA's office. And
I agree.
With your question, you've got to be able to work with your communities.
Yes.
You've got to be able to work with your law enforcement. You have to be effective in your crime fighting. And that, again, goes back to working with the defense bar. The people that make mistakes, you know, get them in, get them out of the system and go with that. But you have got to have a viable working relationship with the law enforcement agencies in your jurisdiction. And quite frankly, you know, I know Aurora's had some issues, if you want to call them that. But when you look across the board, Broomfield to the Sheriff's Office here in Adams County, Westminster, Thornton, North Glen, all those, you know what? They're dedicated men and women, first responders that do nothing but want to take care of their community.
There are a few complaints about the Westminster police officers.
Well, you may have heard.
Hey, Tim, you're a great guy. Let me finish this. Okay. Hey, Tim, you're a great guy, and I endorse you.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks.
And so I wish you the best. And tell how people can help you.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, and I love coming on, you guys. Anytime you want me to, just let me know. We'll set that up. You can go to McCormickforDA.com, McCormickforDA.com. Thanks for everything, and I hope your listeners have a great afternoon and a great weekend.
Same to you. Good luck.
Take care.
All right, we got a jam-packed show today. We're now moving on. I see we have Mark on the line or on Zoom with us. This Zoom thing is great,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
We have a friend, a common friend, who gave us your book, Mark. It's Mark Shankin. Mike, how do I pronounce your last? I should ask that first.
Shankin,
okay. And it's great. It says, Essays on a Life Before, During, and After the Law, and just like that. A friend of us gave us the book, and we...
Tim Smith. Tim Smith knows...
That's right.
Tim Smith knows every interesting person in Colorado. If you don't know Tim, then you're not interesting. I mean, that's what it comes down to.
He's like... And I love the description on the book. And this is really... We're kind of shifting gears. This is just a book review, because it just hit us so good. Not particularly political, but I love this. If you're a law student or an attorney, if you know an attorney, if you live with an attorney, if you're friends with an attorney, if you're curious about an attorney, if you've ever hired an attorney, this is a great, entertaining read, and we absolutely agree. So thank you for your time, and welcome to the show.
Sure. Glad to be here. Very pleased that you'd have me on. Thanks.
You know, we'll have you talk about it in a couple ways, but one of the things, having not been an attorney, Chuck is as yourself, sort of a recovering attorney. I also thought what was really cool about the book was the way you talked about, you know, recognize just changing gears, sort of restarting over, leaving a lucrative golden handcuff kind of career and just sort of starting anew. And so I guess let me kind of open up, and then Chuck he's ever marked pages to read, but what are you doing now, and how is all that going?
Well, I left the practice of law to start doing things where I got to ask the question, what am I giving as opposed to what am I getting? Largely what I'm doing is I'm working for nonprofits here in Denver. I'm on the finance committee for Habitat for Humanity here. I'm on several arts organizations, one in particular, Think 360, which brings art to the Denver public school system, to the inner city and underprivileged kids, all of which was great and is incredibly challenging in the era of COVID.
Yeah.
Revenue streams have dried up to zero, and yet, you know, the kids still need teachers to teach them, and people still need houses to be built for them. So pretty challenging.
Well, in addition to being an attorney, so I could very much appreciate all of that. I was also born in a New York City hospital like you, and had a great change that was incredibly dramatic and stressful.
Chuck is like, this
and
is great school.
It is my story. I know your lovely wife went to Bryn Mawr. My mother went to Bryn Mawr.
Ah.
So I had a lot of connections. But what would you like to tell people about being a lawyer in particular?
How fun it was.
Well, I think I would start with, how did I ever become a lawyer? Because it certainly didn't happen elegantly at all. You know, I stumbled into it. I had been trying all these different things that I might do with my life. I could never have imagined myself, you know, sitting behind a desk and wearing a tie, let alone having partners and clients and judges to have to deal with and opposing counsel. And I was fairly committed to not having that kind of life. But as I continued to try different things, I drove a forklift, I painted lines on the highways, not straight either, so that was a good way to find out that wasn't my destiny. You know, I came upon the idea as I'm graduating from college and trying these other jobs that maybe the thing to do would be to go to law school, and that'll give me three more years to figure out what I really want to do.
Uh-huh.
And I did that. And comes the third year, you know, the third year in law school. I still hadn't figured out what I wanted to do. One of the bankruptcy judges in the district where I was going to school hung in those days, there was no electronics, so a 3x5 card on the placement office wall. You may remember that, Chuck, from law school. I went in and interviewed with him, and shockingly, he actually liked me, and he hired me. Now, I'd never taken a bankruptcy class before, and so I thought, okay, I'll give this a shot. That'll give me 2 more years to figure out what I really want to do. And, you know, the 3 years for me took me 40 years to figure out what I really wanted to do. I was a little slow on the uptake.
Well, I remember in the book you indicated that the bankruptcy judge who you admired a lot said to you that, you know, practicing law may not be all that it's supposed to cracked up to be at times.
Yeah, and I didn't listen to him, but it resonated as life went on, because he was wise, and I should have probed a little bit more as he was telling me that over lunch as I was finishing the clerkship. What exactly?
Well, let me tell you, I clerked for Gene Breitenstein in the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, and he called me, and I don't know, maybe the third day I was there, and said, "What's your exit plan?" Now, exit plan from what? It's exit plan from law. And I go, well, you know, I'm working here, and I'm interviewing on the East Coast and in Denver for a job in a law firm. So I haven't really thought. He said, well, you need to think about it. He said, law is the most wonderful thing to start out in. There's no better way than start out. But if you spend your entire life doing nothing but practicing private practice of law, you will have lived a sad and pathetic life. I go, wow. Okay.
Thank you for the
pet. All right. He said, I've been a federal judge now for 20 years. He said, that's not practicing law. You know, I come in here at 8 and I leave at 5. I got my weekends, I'll do other stuff and I'm special masters, but that's not practicing law. That's just having a good time. He said, but when you find out what the practice of law is really like, the key to your life will be to get out of it.
Why is it so awful, Mark?
So there was a one of the Supreme Court justices, I think it was Justice Story, so this would have been late 1800s, early 1900s, came up with the phrase that the law is a jealous mistress.
Right.
And you hear about that in law school, and I'm not sure you really appreciate it, but it is. And the only way to make it through a long law career is to try to find some kind of balance. And the problem with finding balance, finding something else that you can do besides, be a lawyer, is that this jealous mistress doesn't really let you do that. A judge that's, all over you for, having to file some brief on 24-hour notice, or opposing counsel or clients or your partners or the people that are working with you that you're supposed to be teaching how to be a lawyer. There's a real fight that goes on for the entire law career as to that balance. Now, that may be true for many careers.
Yeah.
Maybe it's true in medicine, one comes to mind. But the difference between medicine and law is I think doctors know what they're getting into as they're finishing their medical training, their internship, and their residency. Lawyers have no idea what they're getting into. Law school doesn't teach you anything about being in a law firm.
Which is a very interesting dynamic. Yeah.
Well, you've talked about that, Chuck. You've got friends, and he's got a friend who is now a judge, and they talk about working in the law.
We were law partners together.
Yeah, and they commiserate. It's sort of like, people have gone through some like horrible traumatic experience where they get together and they say,
PTSD.
PTSD. Remember when this happened? Oh my God, that was terrible.
Well, you had a wonderful quote in it. It's your own quote, kind of derivation of Merriam-Webster's midlife crisis, but it really applies to the practice of law. I just love this one, so I want to read it. And this is practicing law or midlife, a period of protracted, repeated, profound emotional turmoil beginning sometime the second or third year of the practice of law and continuing off and on, mostly on, many times for the rest of the legal career, characterized by a significant, continuous, and oftentimes all-consuming desire to explore alternative possibilities, to explore a change, any change at all, and to effect change. These periods are typically coupled with a constant search for a new dream to pursue, potentially followed by additional periods of intense regret as dreams are not fulfilled. That couldn't describe my law career better, and it couldn't describe most of the attorneys. Now, I know a few. They tend to have been in bigger firms, and they're given sabbaticals, and they were they were kind of the last remaining humane places to work. And they quickly dissolved in the 90s when they got torn apart by whoever billed the most. But that is such a poignant description of what law, practicing law, is like for a lot of people.
Yeah, and how odd that, you know, such a long-standing profession, centuries, mm-hmm. It sort of has come to that. You know, you get the sense that in London in the 1800s, that's not the way lawyers thought about being a barrister. They loved it. They loved it that the society looked up to them. But the practice of law is just very different than it was even when I started.
I must admit, I've read things like from Bernard Darwin, who had a similar one to that, and then became a great golf writer and stuff. Maybe, you know, reading Dickens' Jardine versus Jardine, maybe it wasn't all that different.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, because the book is really very funny when you read it through it. You have a really good touch. I don't know, have you written books before?
I've written two law books, but never anything quite like this. And really my third book, but my book without an actual publishing company. So I didn't know how good I had it before. Yeah.
Because I want to tell you, I mean, it is really funny. If you're not a lawyer or you don't, you know, I think, like I said, there are a lot of bigger lessons, but I love, you talk about secretaries. That was a pretty funny, thing.
That I am not the only person to bring a dictating machine, unfortunately, into the bathroom.
Can you, okay. And then you have another one, learning not to say F you, which was also kind of funny. Can you tell just a couple of anecdotal little stories for folks that I think no matter what career you're in, you can kind of relate to?
Yeah. So the learning not to say F you probably isn't just limited to lawyers, but I think people think that lawyers are very proper people, and, you know, in court, largely they are. But at least in my experience, you know, when you get back to the office in the big law firm, it can be a fairly down and dirty, vulgar existence at times. Mm-hmm. And I think people found that surprising. When I asked a couple of people to read some of the chapters as I was writing this to see if, you know, this was had any attraction whatsoever. And my wife gave it to a doctor friend who read it and was horrified and did not believe that lawyers actually talk that way. I found that funny. I mean, maybe doctors don't, but lawyers do. And lawyers talk that way to other lawyers when they're yelling at them or when they're yelling at a partner. And
Particularly partners who just ripped you off and stole money from the firm. Yes.
There's that. Yeah. But that chapter is more about, you know, the better way to go about how to deal with things rather than just say, you know, F you at the end of every conversation where it might be particularly appropriate. So, you know, other things that you tend to do as a lawyer or say, for example, if you're an associate, you're certainly not going to turn around to a partner and tell them to F off because that'll be the end of the associate gig. So,
yeah. Let him finish.
Yeah. So I thought that chapter was funny. Now, the funny thing about that chapter is when it got to my editor, she read it and described it as jarring.
Jarring?
Yeah.
I thought it was funny.
Yeah. Well, she thought it was jarring. She's British. She's absolutely wonderful, but, you know, she's a PhD.
I worked in a newsroom. So
yeah, okay. Well, I would expect.
Lawyers are always under enormous amount of pressure.
Yeah.
Pressure from their clients, pressure from judges in some cases, depending on your practice, judges, pressure from other partners, pressure from everything. And you're under a real cauldron often, and sometimes without not a lot of sleep and so forth. The idea that everybody's very polite and nice to each other is probably better today because now everybody will say you're bullying them
it's probably got to be tough. That's true.
You know, before you could let off some steam with your secretary if you have one today. It's a very kind of intense. You describe your office as a cell, and it doesn't matter if it's, you know, 10 by 8 or 40 by 40
downtown. I mean,
it still feels like a cell, even though you're overlooking I had offices on top of the Amoco building overlooking all of Denver and everything else, but it still felt like a cell.
It did at times. Certainly, perhaps more as during the associate years than the partner years. But it has that you return each day to serve your time kind of feel to it.
I want to, on the column about the secretaries, you had a funny story that kind of hit home to me. Although I was not the victim, so to speak, as you were, where you talk about, you know, you talk where you were dictating and the secretary And then you had to go to the bathroom, and the secretary included all of that in the transcripts. We were at one time recording, we were doing a story with some undercover cops, and we put microphones on them, right? And so this is a, for anyone out there, turn the microphone off and you go to the bathroom, because the photographer, I mean, you know, we're sitting there with the headphones on, and the cop, we didn't realize this, took a brief bathroom break, and we heard, just like you, we heard this, this noise, and finally we realized what was going on. It was like, ah!
Yeah. So well, that particular secretary was looking for any way to get out of being my secretary.
Yeah,
that's a good way.
Yeah, that's a good one.
She got the goods on that one.
All right. You know, let me ask you, because we only have a few more minutes with you. We have a packed show today. Talk about your decision or your realization to get, because that happened with me, with Chuck. I mean, we have changed careers, got in and out of things. And I think it's a kind of thing that people, you can be so scared to do. And then once you do it, you're like, well, is that, what am I so scared of? Right. I mean, talk about how you came to the realization that you needed to do this and then how you carried it off.
Yeah. It's an interesting process. There's a lot of books written on, you know, the changing careers and how people do it. I read a number of them, maybe a lot of them. I didn't find them particularly helpful. It was interesting to hear how other people managed to exit whatever they were doing, but it wasn't particularly applicable to me. And part of the problem was, you know, how would I know when it was time?
Yeah.
You know, I'd done it 39 years, not including the 3 years in law school. And you know, I'd done everything that you could do as a bankruptcy lawyer. So that was one checkbox, perhaps. I wasn't doing anything particularly new. I think you just sort of know. It's not a very satisfying answer to the how did you know, but you just sort of know. You walk in to work one day and you decide, okay, that's it, I'm ready. But the real problem is I wasn't really ready to retire, and I hate the word retire. I would love to be busier than I was as an attorney. I just don't feel like going to court anymore and calling witnesses, right, et cetera. So how you put together the next things that you're interested in doing is important. And I had a little help with that. From an outfit named My Next Season heard me talk and helped me sort of put together other things I could do. But what you really need to do, which is what I didn't do when I was going down the path of being a lawyer, is find something that you're passionate about.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things in life that I have learned that I love. I love art. I love music. I love helping people, you know, get into homes. Because the effect it has on all of these problems in society, you know, you want to solve the education problem, solve the housing problem. You want to solve the gang problem, solve the housing problem. And Habitat does it one house at a time. And I'm not Jimmy Carter, but you know, it works for me.
Yeah.
And it gives me something that I can do. They'll take as much time. All of the organizations will take as much time as I would have to give. And I'm lucky I'm healthy and I have a lot of time to give. And all of a sudden, I can ask myself at the end of the day, well, what did I give? How did I help? And boy, that makes me feel good.
Did you ever read the book About Schmidt by Louis Bagley?
No.
You should read it. And he was a lawyer with Debevoise and Plimpton. Schmidt is a partner, and he's taken early retirement, sort of like you. And it you'll find it very enjoyable to read. There's a movie with Jack Nicholson that has, you know, they bought the book rights and then did it about an insurance actuarial, and it really has nothing to do with the book they bought. But I think you'd find it very enjoyable, and it certainly has the same themes you're talking about.
I'll check it out.
Yeah.
And here's the book, okay? And just like that, we've already had people texting us and chatting with us, wanting to know where can they buy it. And I told you, shamelessly self-promote here, where can people find this book and where can they get their hands on it?
So print or electronic, Barnes & Noble, iTunes, Amazon, just search for my name or just search for Ann, just like that. And it's showing up in some bookstores. That process took a little longer. The whole self-publication process is new to me and fascinating, but it moves a little slowly. But
well, your last name is spelled for people who want you to go under. It's Mark Shaken. And now Julie's taken away, so I'm supposed to memorize it. Shaken.
All right, and just like that.
Yeah, thanks very much. Enjoy.
All right, Mark, thank you. Good luck. Appreciate your time.
Say hello to Tim for us.
I shall. Thanks, guys.
And I see Father Hugh is on the line. Hugh, I'm going to put you, not going to take you yet because we've got another guest booked. So if anybody's calling in and wants to comment and we don't get you in today, please call back on Monday because we can continue sort of the conversation. But I want to bring
Hugh would be great on. I want to hear his comments.
Hugh, so if we don't get to you, call back Monday, please.
We'll try to get to you, but.
Yeah. But Jan, we got Jan Cook with us now, grassroots activist. Speaking of books, there is a new book coming out. There you go. Okay, Jan, tell us about that. And this seems to me to be a really good idea.
Yeah. What's going on is all of the people, you're going to be familiar. These are all the central figures right now, the authors, whether you know their names or not, and you're going to know many of the names. These are the figures. The book is Unmasked 2020, Colorado's Radical Left Turn, and a warning to America, because this is not just about Colorado. What's happening here is being duplicated all across the
country.
And the people, the central figures who have been fighting what's going on in policy, the lawmakers, they're wanting to share and explain what's happening. And so I encourage people, we need help because we need seed money to get the initial publishing costs handled. So if they just go to the website unmasked2020.co for Colorado, it's easy to remember. Everything about the book, some of the authors, the chapters that they'll be covering are there, right there, easy to do. And then they can click if they want to help support, get this word out in this important election year. This book is slated to be published in early September, so plenty of time. And I got to tell you, Chuck and Julie, as you're out there talking to your neighbors and family, are you finding that a lot of people are still unaware of what's going on in Denver? And I'm just astounded. And I'd like to hear from you. Why do you think so many people still don't know what's going on in our state?
Because we're like New Jersey, which I spent part of my life. Younger life. And, you know, we don't really have a paper anymore. We have no mass. You know, you're the Denver Post, you know, this dinky little rag. There's almost, you know, we have three news stations that, you know, Kyle Clark and everything else. Mm-hmm. They're not going to find out. There's no way to find out unless they really, you know, go to Colorado Citizen Press or a few others. But there is nothing out there.
There's nothing out there. Do you know, I heard a story where a guy took his 90-some-year-old mother out for breakfast, and she did not believe him that what was going on in Denver, and he took her for a drive. And she said, why am I not hearing about this on the news? I never heard any that this was actually going on. And this is just a couple of weeks ago. So the thing that I just want to impress upon everybody, this isn't just another columnist book, you know, a topic that you want to write about, that you are sparked some sort of interest in. These are real policymakers who are in the trenches right now dealing with this, and they are writing in-depth chapters to help us understand. Now, granted, they have to be careful not to be a textbook, and they won't be, but this is going to be real policy type information so that you understand the implications.
And the way I understand it, or at least my take on it, is it kind of picks up Colorado, the blueprint Colorado simply explained how the Democrats 10 years ago started taking over. What this book does is it kind of takes it a step further and says, oh, here's exactly what they've been doing.
This is the result.
Right.
This is the outcome.
Right. And this is not an accident. And you know, Chuck, you're right. It's like, how do you find out what's going on? Because I think a lot of people, things are so political and so divisive. They're just like, oh, you know, I don't want to talk about that. I just want to, I don't know what, not think about that. Think about happy things. And I get that. But the trouble is the mainstream media in Denver doesn't cover it at all. You know, with the Glendale Cherry Creek Chronicle, they're always trying to close us down,
right?
Because they don't like what we have to say. And then the neighbors say, please don't ever stop. Somebody needs to tell the truth. But it's books like this, because I really believe this is not a time, you're either part of the solution or you're part of the problem in this day and age. I don't even care, even if you're a Democrat, right? Maybe you totally disagree with my solution, but this is not a time, I think, in this country where you can just kind of stand still. And I think that's why these kind of books are great, because they give you the information.
Oh, and the other thing I would just like to say, when you get to know the authors like Jeff Hunt and Kevin Lundberg and Dave Williams, you both love Dave Williams, Representative Williams, Rob Woodward. These are Kim Ranson on the Joint Committee.
There's a lot of different views on things from Rob Woodward to Dave Williams. I mean, so you're getting a whole panoply of thoughts in that.
And Tony Gagliardi.
Tony, we've had Tony businesses
and our friend Randy Corcoran.
Yeah. Right.
There's content experts here. This is, like I said, it's a deep dive. But here's the other thing I'd like you folks to understand. First of all, I want to thank, we have 20% of the people have donated already to unmasked2020.co. And we're only looking for about 8,500, 36 contributors so far. Come on, people. Dennis Prager has a fabulous quote. There are those who fight, those who support the fighters, and those who do nothing. This is the opportunity to do something and contribute at least to the startup costs. The thing that most people don't realize, because this is going to be a paper book as well as electronic, when you have a Kindle book and you like this book, this author that you just had on, be reading, and if a quote like you just read from that book, in a Kindle, you can take that quote and immediately upload it onto Twitter and Facebook. Did you,
Chuck? Yeah, that's my technical.
So this is my point. This book, we will be able to quote and send this and get this information out virally on Facebook and on Twitter.
One more time, real quick, Jan, because we got to wrap it up here. Where do people need to go?
Okay, go to unmasked2020.co, just like Colorado. unmasked2020.co, a link to donate and help support, get this information out. Support our authors. These are the people that are constantly fighting for us. And also, a little bit more about the book is all there at that website. And I think you're going to interview some of our authors
next week. Exactly.
That'd be great.
Perfect. And thanks.
I really appreciate your help on this. Come on. All right. Help support this effort. Thank you, Jan.
Thank you, Jan.
I'll stay on and listen.
Okay.
All right.
Well, that's kind of wrapping it up.
Well, Hugh, I want you to call back Monday or whenever it's coming, because I want to have an extended conversation with you, because you've been there. You've been with the equivalent of Plimpton and Debevoise or Debevoise and Plimpton and led the life that I think Mr. Shankin.
So Hugh, you're the first one up on Monday if you call back. We got to go now, you guys. Check out the website, chuckandjulie.com. If you came in late and you want to listen to something, you can get all of the archives, all of the messages there. Thank you to Sandra and everybody else chiming in on the chat side. Thank you to everybody on Zoom. Thank you to all our guests.
And get partying is Friday.
And special thanks to the guys at BBS, Doug Dunn and Thomas. And now it's time to party. Everybody will see you Monday.